And we have the similar discussions about vaccine, whether to have a vaccine. He's allergic to penicillin. The whole story yesterday about allergies, which I just find fascinating because I do clinical trials. And, you know, this, it's not unusual to get adverse responses in any drug. That doesn't mean you stop using the drug. And, you know, I think he's the kind of patient that, you know, when the vaccine's available, he needs to have it so that we can get back to some kind of normal life. But also, even when we do get through this, is it actually right that we put someone in an ambulance to come to hospital just to come and see Dr. Nickel for 5 minutes, when actually shouldn't we be using video and things to do this? And that brings me on to my other discussion, is just I cannot believe the discussions I have had with next of kin, with patients, in effect via Zoom, that, you know, there is nothing that I won't talk about. So, you know, end of life care, what their views are about, what treatments you would want, you know, on Monday, and, you know, motor neuron disease, I'll give you as an example. So progressive neurological disease, which, you know, is very much life limiting, having to have a discussion with a guy who lives in a tower block in Birmingham, to basically worried that he was getting care, and I mean care, because he's so petrified getting out of his flat that he might catch coronavirus, that he's not seeing his relatives, and yet we need to get him to see the motor neuron disease specialist nurse and things. It's really hard. So you end up having conversations like we are now, but via Zoom, saying, well, have you thought about what your wishes would be in the event of a life-threatening illness, this kind of thing. You know, there's no way I would have that conversation pre-pandemic. So, you know, I think the world is going to be different. It's not going to be normal. And then the next question is, how quickly you're going to come out? And I, you know, I think this is going to take a lot longer than many people realize. And, you know, I think it's fantastic news about the vaccine. The natural history of something like a coronavirus epidemic is you're going to get peaks in the winter. It's going to come down in the spring, but it may come up again. So lots and lots of questions really that center about whether the vaccine will stop infectivity. We know that it is that they're very effective at stopping hospitalizations and serious illness, and that's fantastic news. But what we need to know is really whether it'll make a difference in terms of whether it stops the spread of infection. Now, I suspect it probably does, largely because we know that where people are asymptomatic, they're less likely to be infective. So if we're stopping people with a vaccine from getting more seriously ill, then it's more likely that it's less likely to be spread, but we don't actually know the evidence for that yet. So I'm going to stop. That's a bit of my clinical background and explain where we come. And perhaps I would just move on and introduce Wilhelm, and who I've been following. It's interesting, the people you follow on Twitter. I have started following some of the lab scientists and things. So I started following Wilhelm on Twitter earlier this year, not realizing he lives around the corner in Bromsgrove, which is ultimately why we got to meet. So what I am looking forward to when we get back to normal is going for a pint with Wilhelm at the end of this.
Thanks, David. Looking forward to that as well. So let me see if I can share my screen.
I think whilst you're doing that, Wilhelm, if I just remind everyone, there's been some fantastic questions so far. So thank you for those. I'm noting them down. So please keep them coming.
Right. So I think you should all be able to see my screen now. My name is Willem van Schaik. I'm a professor of microbiology and infection at the University of Birmingham. I moved to the Midlands in 2017 from the Netherlands, hence the accent. But I've been working on bacterial pathogens for about 20 years now. And so I work on bacteria, not on viruses. Coronavirus, COVID, basically started for me, or my personal story with COVID-19 started because we have an ongoing project with partners in China to understand how bacteria that no longer respond to antibiotic therapy, which is another important threat to public health, but how these spread in Chinese hospitals. And we were planning, we had been plan was a long time in the making, to go to China in February this year to discuss the latest results of our project. And then, of course, we followed the news and we were aware of the COVID-19 outbreak in Wuhan and how that spread across across China. And none of our partners were in Wuhan, but mid-January, we started sending them emails asking, is it still safe to come over to China? If you look back on it, it's insane that we even considered that question. But they got back to us with a couple of emails that I'm going to share with you now. So one of the clinicians said that he has continuously worked in the hospital for 2 weeks and said that the pandemic was very serious. And the other said that he was too busy with the coronavirus pneumonia and that he could not leave. So it was quite clear at that stage in January that we were talking about a really serious disease. And that point became even clearer in February. I think David already referred to that when we saw these outbreaks on cruise ships, which spread very rapidly, so which clearly indicated that people that are elderly are at a very high risk and that there was airborne transmission was very likely to be an important cause of spread of the virus. And then, of course, in March 2020, this is basically when I and colleagues of mine at the University of Birmingham really started losing it, when we saw photos like these at the Cheltenham Festival. I do actually go to the Cheltenham Festival. I really like horse races. I didn't go in March 2020 because I realized that even though all these people are outside, if you go to Cheltenham, you also spend a significant time inside with lots of other people. So there's lots of opportunities for spread of any respiratory infection. And so for that reason, I and other scientists basically started letting our voices heard and basically pointed out that the strategy that the UK government was following at that time was very different from what the World Health Organization was advising and what other European countries were doing. Of course, then it took, this is the 14th of March, I think we went into lockdown on the 23rd of March, and it's now broadly accepted that that was certainly 1 or 2 weeks too late. So these are the things that I've learned over the last year. There's a lot more, but these are the things that I think are very important for everybody to keep in mind, that we know that COVID-19 spreads by direct contact, but also by droplets and aerosols that are floating around in the air. It's important to continue to realize that these sort of super spreader events, that could be church services, what else have we had? Well, potentially even Cheltenham, the Cheltenham races, although we don't really have any data like that, but at least large congregations of people where many people are together in relatively small spaces is basically a recipe for disaster when it comes to COVID-19. David already referred to Taiwan, and it's one of those countries that have done really well during this pandemic. And that strategy has been followed by other countries as well, including South Korea, Finland and Australia, and also other European. Norway has done a really good job as well. And basically what they've done, they've had a really efficient test, trace and isolate system and travel restrictions, and that has kept COVID-19 under control. And that's a very other very important point to make. If you are able to do that, then you also minimize economic damage. Even a country like Taiwan has seen economic damage because basically their exports have cratered over the first few months of 2020, but their recession will not be as deep as the recession that we are going to have in the UK. And then finally, one thing that I got wrong, I was actually not convinced until April this year that masks would work, but now there's very strong evidence that masks definitely contribute to minimizing the spread of COVID-19. So I completely agree that we should continue to wear these when we are in public places. And then finally, is that vaccines work. And David already referred to that. It's amazing that we've gone from the identification of a new virus to a working vaccine in a year. That's never been done before. I was actually quite skeptical that these vaccines would even work, because people have studied the common cold, which is caused by related viruses, for decades, never been able to develop a virus, a vaccine, excuse me. But now for COVID-19, we have a working vaccine. So this is data that was published today in one of the leading medical journals, which shows the performance of the Pfizer vaccine. And I won't bore you with all the details, but here on the left in blue, that's where you see the people that were in the clinical trial of the Pfizer vaccine and that got a placebo, essentially no vaccine in this case. And you can see here on the left, that's the number of people that get infected. And over time, you can see that people get COVID, essentially, if they're not protected. And this is the response of just one single dose of the Pfizer vaccine. And you can see that, of course, it takes a little bit of time, about 10 days, for people to build up immunity. And then there's hardly any additional case of COVID-19 in the vaccinated group. So we now have a working vaccine. And of course, the logistics of rolling this out, not just in the UK, but across the globe, are going to be immense. It's like putting a man on the moon while building a spaceship at the same time. It's not going to be easy, but this is a phenomenal achievement. And I do truly believe that it is cause for optimism, and that we might be at a stage that is closer to normal. I completely agree with David. It's going to be a long time before we go back to normal, but closer to normal, somewhere in May, June, July, let's say summer 2020, when things are basically, when things are going well. I would like to leave it at that, and then maybe we can start taking questions. I will stop sharing my screens, and then we can start taking questions.
Yeah, thank you. And we've got plenty of them, which is great. So thank you very much to everybody who's done that. Give me one moment. Okay. Right. So we've got questions on all manner of things, folks. In summary, we're going to talk about men and ethnic minorities specifically related to COVID. We've got the order of the vaccine, the government's order. We're going to be covering questions on that. Brexit, there's some questions relating to that. Anaphylaxis. Social distancing measures, we've got some questions there. There's one about personalising the vaccine, very interesting question, and some information from you on the other vaccines and what you think of them. But if we begin with a question from somebody that couldn't attend tonight, but is planning to watch the recording. It's if the BAME community are more susceptible to dying from COVID, would they not be prioritised for the vaccine? Now, in addition to that, if I can give you another question which is similar. So Emily, who's with us this evening, gave us our first question. So thank you, Emily. And that was, is more research going to be done into why men and ethnic minorities and black people are more affected by this virus than others? And was this the case in other pandemics? Over to you.
Well, there's a few questions. You want to go?
Yeah. Shall I start, and then maybe you can pick up on that later? So these are really important questions. It's really well established now that ethnic minorities in this country are at a higher risk, and men are at a higher risk of developing serious disease and dying from COVID. And just for 2 minutes, we have to talk about race. So what is race? And it is very important for all of us to realize that race is not a real biological concept. Race describes a skin color and not much more than that. The differences in the genetics that I have with David might be very much larger than somebody who's coming from Kenya. The difference in the human, we look at skin color, but that's only part of the variation that we have. So what is most likely the reason why ethnic minorities are at a higher risk of developing serious disease and dying of COVID is because they are in a socioeconomically deprived circumstances. They're living in poorer jobs. They find it more difficult to self-isolate than people that are richer and that are more predominantly white. So that leads to a higher risk of them catching COVID And if you catch COVID, there's of course a risk that people will die. And it's those reasons why members of the BAME community are more likely to be at risk of COVID. That is something that has been a theme of pandemics throughout human history. It's always the poorest in society that suffer the most. And that is sadly the case in the UK in the 21st century as well. How that should affect vaccination policies is a really difficult question. And I do have to admit that I don't have really strong opinions or even knowledge about this. I would say that the main risk factor still remains age. So people over 80 are at very much higher risk than people over 70 and et cetera, et cetera. So it does make sense, I believe, to start to use that as the main criterion for vaccinating people. Because if you vaccinate 80-year-olds, you're going to vaccinate everyone, not just including people with different ethnicities. David, do you want to add anything
to that? Just to explore on that, I mean, I think all the health disparities we already knew about have been made much worse in this pandemic. So if you look at the rising figures in London, for example, they're all in the East End, where communities are really, you know, cheek by jowl sort of thing. Whereas frankly, the posher areas are, you know, managing better because they're able to keep a greater distance and things. And, you know, I think there's so many challenges are going to be with this pandemic looking on, is how do we deal with those health inequalities and things. I'm saying this as a primer because it's someone I know we've been talking with the Lib Dems, for example, about Michael Marmo, a public health doctor who's a legend in public health. And actually what this pandemic has shown is actually a failure of public health policy to deal with health inequalities and things. And I know he's doing a review on just this aspect that's coming out next Tuesday. But it also leads into the vaccination program, because there's been a fundamental, you know, failure of trust in our leaders and government and things like that. And that's true not just in the UK, but many other countries as well. And I particularly worry about BME community and things. So actually, we really need to think quite, you know, really engage with our BME leaders and how that's going to happen, basically. I don't know if you saw, there was a headline in the Daily Mirror earlier this week, and it just had a bunch of white celebrities on it, you know, saying how we're going to have the vaccine. And, you know, where was the Lenny Henry? Where was, you know, the Atul Khan, you know, many others. And so actually it becomes almost about the psychology of behavior of actually how do we promote vaccination as a positive thing. And this leads on to the whole fake news stuff. And already, you know, is it Bill Gates implant theories of vaccination and stuff? That's going to be a real, real challenge, and how we deal with that is a big issue.
I was going to say, David, the other part of the question was about men as well, and I think we've covered some of the race stuff there, which is great, but actually there's no reason why men should be worse than women in socioeconomic terms. I mean, actually, I think you could probably argue that men are wealthier on average than women. So yeah, what's the difference there?
I'm an expert on this because I'm a man. But the men are generally not as healthy as women, is a short answer to that. So they're more likely to be obese. They're more likely to smoke. There's a couple of these risk factors. They're more likely to have type 2 diabetes than women. And that's one of the underlying reasons why men are more at risk of COVID-19. There's a couple of other things that we don't really understand. There might be differences in the way that the immune response of men is different from women, but I think it's most likely that men are more likely to have these risk factors of serious disease.
Is there a question actually for you, Philip, on, but also relates to ethnicity? One of the things I don't understand, and I really don't understand, is you know, somewhere like Taiwan, 7 deaths, okay? They had direct flights from Wuhan, okay? Yeah. Yet we know, and this is a very interesting study where they looked at sewage data in Italy, that coronavirus was around mid-December in Italy. I just can't figure that out, you know, how they managed to deal with that so well. But is it maybe an HLA type, so they've got a different immunity or maybe exposure to, I don't know, just why there's such variation in figures.
I'm not sure if Taiwan is the best example of the, clearly they've done an amazing job, but they probably have never had any, let's say, influx of cases at very high numbers because of the political tensions between China and Taiwan. There's actually very little travel between those two countries. It is South Korea that has done an amazing job in, because they do get a lot of travel from China into South Korea, into very quickly isolating those, testing, tracing, and isolating. And they've done that essentially from day one, because they had the experience from SARS, and they implemented that almost immediately, and that has been a tremendous success for them.
Okay, but I'm banned from asking any more questions.
I'm not ruling out any biological mechanism, but I think it's, in all these things, it's probably more likely that there's some kind of socioeconomic or policy reason for countries doing better than others.
Let's move on to the next question, because we've got a lot actually, I want to try and get as many as we can through. So John Taylor asks, has the government got the order of vaccination right, given the storage and transit requirements for the Pfizer vaccine? And perhaps if you can add in that what some of those conditions are, just in case anyone's not aware.
Yeah, okay. Well, the Pfizer one particular, because it's got to be stored at minus 70, so that does create issues. And I think there's 375 vaccines in a pack, okay? So that's quite a challenge if you're trying to deliver that, the at-risk group, say, you know, frail elderly in a care home. How do you do that and not waste vaccine? So an awful lot of thought has gone into that. And so it's, you know, the logistics of this are really, really important, okay? Plus, you've got to make sure everyone has a second jab at 3 weeks' time. So what I would say, the good thing I would say the NHS has got is that we've got an excellent primary care system, and they're used to doing vaccines. In many ways, I think it's a strong advantage that we've got. And we just got to let, for God's sake, don't ring your GP about this. I would say your GP will contact you. We've got very good systems for doing that, basically. So I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add on that.
I think the question was whether this was the right order, and I think the order is more or less, as in, the Pfizer vaccine is the first vaccine that we have available, so it makes perfect sense to start working with that one, and in the meantime wait for the approval and efficacy data of the other vaccines that are in development.
And the other question on this that also got raised is, the evidence is that this reduces severe disease, okay? Mm-hmm. We haven't as yet got the evidence that it stops infection. And if we know that the elderly are particularly at risk, they're the right group to be focusing on, because this, you know, is very bad news if you're in your, you know, mid-70s and above, basically. So, you know, trying to focus on, the older you are, the bigger the risk is important.
Yep.
From an amateur perspective, where this is concerned, we know that the Oxford vaccine was, I think, a week behind the Pfizer one or something like that. It was very close, wasn't it? So presumably it's a week or thereabouts behind being approved finally. So I actually wonder whether, you know, the strategy behind this is just for the care homes, at least wait for that one, because that one just needs cold storage. It doesn't need special storage.
Well, some of that, I would say also, if you need to think globally, you know, also is the fact that you don't have to use minus 70 is a huge thing for, you know, developing world and elsewhere, basically. South Africa at the moment is going through a second wave, as an example. So that is a massive difference, basically. I'm saying this in Bromsgrove because I'm back to the whole MMR discussion. There was a whole debate then about, you know, single jabs versus MMR. And I remember at the time, the then MP, Julie Kirkbride, was very passionate. People should have the choice. So I sent her a Christmas present of an MMR vaccine for the developing world to make the point that it was safe. The logistics of this are massive.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move on to David, your favourite subject now, it's Brexit. And we've got two, I'm going to read out two questions to you and then you can both take them as you wish. So Richard Whelan asks, will a no-deal Brexit cause significant disruption to the distribution of the Pfizer vaccine? If so, will other vaccines like Oxford's, if it is approved, make up for the delay in distribution of the Pfizer one? Or will a no-deal Brexit cause significant disruption no matter what? And what can that be done if that disruption is caused? And then Claire E asks, will border delays seem inevitable in a no-deal and a no-deal Brexit mean the Pfizer vaccine is at significant risk of deterioration given storage sensitivities? So Brexit, how is it going to impact us?
I could see that question coming. Okay. So, gosh, I can't believe that nothing has changed since April 2019, when I ended up whistleblowing to Newsnight over the no deal plans for Brexit and Operation Yellowhammer. And that was nothing, you know, this is before the pandemic, and that was specifically in relation to drugs for epilepsy. What I would put in context with this, the job I had to do then was essentially we had a traffic light system. And to be honest, I'd be surprised if it's any different. And it would be basically looking at what the condition is, what the drug is, what would the implication of not being able to get access to that drug. So in my case, it was drugs for epilepsy. And, you know, I just looked and said, you know, if the patient cannot get this drug because we can't stockpile 6 weeks, we fly it in. Okay. An interesting report in the Observer just this week saying if there's problems with vaccine supply, we'll get the military to fly in. So I suspect it'll be something similar. You know, medicine supply will be the most important issue. Now, it's interesting, just given how involved we were a year ago, and for God's sake, I stood in the election because of this. I can honestly say there has been no email correspondence at all about Brexit. Apart from I had one email yesterday from the Trust saying, you know, think about your supplies. And this is so 2020, there was an email from NHS England saying there's going to be a webinar sometime before the end of the year when the politicians have decided what's happening about drug supply. Oh, very 2020. So I haven't got the date of the webinar yet, but presumably it'll be sometime in the next couple of weeks. it's just mad. But so I think it is going to be challenging, but I think where something is, you know, life-saving, if they're talking about the military flying vaccines in, then I think people are taking it seriously. I just hope they've got enough planes for everything else. You know, I think it is inevitable that there is going to be some problems for all sorts of different things. You know, when they're building truck parks, not just in Kent, but, you know, next to Birmingham Airport and things. In fact, I got so worried about this in February, okay? I ended up doing a video describing this as Mission Impossible, dealing with the pandemic and the consequence of Brexit. But there we are. You know, essentially, this is a political decision. And, you know, we were all told this was Project Fair. But, you know, I'm sure it'll all get sorted out in the next couple of weeks.
Willem, have you got anything you want to add to this? Because you may have a different perspective to us as well.
Well,
maybe not.
I personally feel that, let's say that I think that was in the papers this week about the military flying in vaccines. I just don't see how that's going to happen in any real numbers. The military is obviously of this country is great, but they don't have a particularly strong track record in shipping things at minus 80, which or minus 70, which is a, you need specific equipment for that. You need specific skills for that. There are international hauliers that can do this. I do fear that it's going to minimize access to some of the, let's say the Pfizer and possibly the Moderna vaccines. And I think one of the questions was whether the Oxford vaccine will help in that, and it might. I do have to say that I actually, and maybe I should have looked this up, but I don't know where the Oxford vaccine will be produced. I know it's obviously been developed in Oxford, but I'm not entirely sure whether it will be
produced. It is, in some in the UK.
It is producing. Okay, yeah. That's great.
So, good knowledge,
that will make things a little bit easier. But right now, the Oxford vaccine has not been approved yet, so we can't use it. And right now, we just have to work with the Pfizer vaccine.
But the analogy I would make is that if you're doing emergency planning, and I was doing emergency planning on pharmaceuticals last year, is that you plan for the things that you can, you know, expect, okay? Mm. So in fact, the government's had years to plan for this, but you can't deal with the things that are unexpected. You know, although you could actually say there was gonna be a pandemic at some point, but to actually try and deal with this and a pandemic, it's crazy.
It's like 3 weeks until Brexit. It's just a disaster.
Especially in winter, because you've got your own logistics supplies then with winter, which all the truck people said it'd be much easier in the summer.
We're going to move on, folks, to anaphylaxis, which was the word of the day yesterday, wasn't it? Everybody was talking about anaphylaxis. And Martine's got a great question. She's also given some follow-up information, so bear with me on that. So Martine asks, my son has multiple life-threatening allergies, anaphylaxis, and I'm wondering which vaccine will be safest for him. He has to have a particular flu vaccine already. Now, I asked her what the allergies were, and they are peanut, tree nut, egg, legumes, lupin, sesame, shrimp, seafood. And then Martine also adds she's got an allergy to penicillin, so what could she have? Do we know what allergies the clinicians had who had the reactions?
I don't know that level of detail, but it actually goes back to the conversation I had this morning with my patient in the care home. And as we said at the very beginning, COVID is a particularly at risk to the elderly. Okay, so in fact, I'm afraid, Martine, your son would be right down the list, because we'd need to be focusing on the elderly, because a young person getting COVID, even with those allergies, their risk to them in terms of life is much less. In fact, a figure I saw, I think David Spiegelhalter are talking about, you know, the risk of death in someone under the age of 35 of COVID, you've got more likelihood of being killed in a car accident in the next 12 months. So, you know, actually understanding risk is really important. So with my patient who was, I think, 79, okay, who was allergic to penicillin, but he's not using an EpiPen. And the two cases we know yesterday were two healthcare workers who clearly had very severe allergies that they needed an EpiPen, both recovered. So this would be standard practice for any new drug to report the reaction. So, I mean, I was slightly bemused because I was thinking, the trials I'm involved with, if I get any reaction, do I just report to the BBC? Whereas most of us, it's a bit of red tape that you would never hear about. So for a younger person like that, I don't think that's really a question, but we will get an idea because there'll be more data, because there'll be more patients exposed to these vaccines. So we'll get a better idea from the safety data as we go along. And then we'll get a better understanding about whether the vaccine stops infectivity, which is the real answer. If your son was using an EpiPen, then I would say that's probably a very bad idea.
Thank you.
I have a vaccine. Okay.
Yeah. We've got one from Ian. I'm going to ask the question. I think you answered this earlier on, but you may want to add something else. So Ian asked, how long do you think those who are vaccinated will have to continue social distancing and be mindful of hands, face, space?
That's a very good question. But I don't think we know the answer until we have that answer about whether it stops infection. So it's really, really important people follow the rules. So I'm sorry, I would say have a quiet Christmas, you know, wash your hands and everything else. And in fact, I'm slightly worried that people just think, I mean, even some of the stuff that Boris was saying this week, you know, have a test and then we'll have a wedding, you know, is not helpful. You know, so I that's why I say getting back to normal, even though I've said normal is going to be different, is going to be some months basically. I think we need to, I think a more interesting question is what's going to happen in terms of vaccine differential, for example. So if one country gets their vaccine plan sorted out, then how is that going to affect travel? Tricky one. You know, if you've got a younger person who's not vaccinated, but they want to go on a holiday, are they going to fly? They're going to another country that hasn't got the vaccine. All kinds of interesting questions there about vaccine transport and, you know, passports and that sort of thing, basically. So on testing, this is my own lateral flow test from this morning that I had. I'm nervous about those because there's a whole false negative issue with that as well, basically. So don't change your behavior.
I think that let's say the data that I showed that you might be protected from serious disease or infection yourself after 2 weeks after getting the vaccination, but that doesn't mean that you can't spread the virus. We just don't know that right now. So if people get vaccinated right now, I would hope that they will continue to socially distance, wear a mask, wash their hands, and do all those things that we've been doing for the next few months. And then maybe over spring, when we have more data, then we can be a bit more fine-grained in our advice. But right now, if you get a jab, don't go running into, I don't know, don't start mingling with lots of people. It's just very unwise.
Okay, thank you, folks. The next question we've got is from Athanasios, and I think this is a really interesting question. Is there any way to personalise the vaccine dose and at the same time take into account any health issues that the person carries? What's your take on that?
The way I'd answer is, because someone asked on the radio, which vaccine would you have? Okay. What's really striking is that they all seem very effective. I mean, not just a bit effective. Most people take a cutoff of 50% is good for your standard flu vaccine. So it's remarkable, these results. We just haven't got that level of evidence. I mean, maybe, and that's why we have a monitoring program for any kind of vaccine program. So, you know, like the allergies, I think we'll get a better idea. What I would say is if you've got particular health issues, then that's even more reason to think that actually having a vaccine is a good idea, because ultimately what we're trying to do is save lives by reducing infectivity. And if someone has got, you know, a serious chronic health illness, what I sort of think about the 75-year-old hypertensive diabetic, which is a lot of people, or in my instance, someone who's got chronic neurological disease, I worry about them. So my clinics are generally, have you had your flu jab? And, I hope you're first in the queue to get your coronavirus vaccine. I wouldn't get picky about which one.
Can I pick you up on hypertensive, David, in case that's a word that not everybody would understand?
Sorry, blood pressure.
Excellent, thank you. Okay, William, did you want to answer that one?
I know that you have dozens of other questions to go through.
Me too,
I have nothing
to
ask.
Very good. Welcome, Nick Hine. Nice to see you here. We've got your question coming up now. Can our panel give us any updates on the Oxford, AstraZeneca or Moderna vaccine? Are there any other challenges? The AstraZeneca vaccine is 90% cheaper and easier to distribute, so we'll be waiting for that to be better. And how has the Pfizer vaccine been approved so quickly versus the rest of the world? Good questions.
Can you repeat that last bit, Jennifer?
Of course I can, yes. So the last part was about the Pfizer vaccine. How has the Pfizer vaccine been approved so quickly versus the rest of the world?
Maybe I can start responding to this. So the reason why the Pfizer vaccine has been approved so quickly is because they basically provided data that was crystal clear, a very well set up clinical trial. And so the MHRA has reviewed those data and have approved the vaccine. And I think now in the United States, they are going through a similar process, and I would expect them to be approved before Christmas as well. Moderna is a little bit later than Pfizer. So maybe MHRA is currently having meetings on the Moderna vaccine as well. It might be approved in the UK before Christmas. I just don't know. AstraZeneca is slightly different because their clinical trial has not been set up in the same very structured way as the Pfizer vaccine. So it's been spread over different countries, and there was a difference between that a subgroup in that trial got a different first dose, which was lower, which was due to human error. And that makes it a little bit more difficult for those that check on let's say the validity of the data to make a decision on whether the vaccine is effective. I do on all the data that's been published, because earlier this week there was the publication of the AstraZeneca vaccine and today of the Pfizer vaccine, the in both cases they look very effective, and in both cases they look very safe. So that's something that we can be quite certain of. So I would expect that maybe AstraZeneca might have to wait a bit more before they get more people in a more standardized trial context before they get approved. Moderna might get approved a bit sooner than that. But this, I have to emphasize, this is speculation on my from my side. I have no particular inside information about how MHRA is reviewing these different vaccines.
Okay. Anything else, David? Or shall I? So, I mean, the other parts were the were there any other challenges to the vaccines we've already got? Because I mean, you mentioned I think 40 that are in the pipeline. So, are there any other names we should be listening out for?
I don't know. I mean, I'm including everything. I'm including Sputnik V, and there was one. And United Arab Emirates, and so you know, I think that's just it. You know, it's really trust is so important. That's why the regulatory process is really important. I don't know if there any other anyone's had to deal with the MHRA. Knows just how tough they are in terms of regulation. I think the vaccine nationalism doesn't help. You know, it's not that surprising that there's a difference in speed between the MHRA and the European Medicines Agency, or indeed the FDA, you know, trying to make it out that it's some kind of British vaccine. The nature of these things, you know, it's complicated. So actually, you know, in a global pandemic, you work collaboratively together to try and sort it out. And, you know, I think, you know, the issues of actually how we deal with this and how we deal with, you know, how some countries have got more vaccine potentially than there are people in the country, whereas other countries don't have any. How we deal with that kind of disparity is a real global public health challenge, I think.
And maybe this is a question that came up, but it's an important point that I want to make here. So some people feel, okay, this has gone incredibly fast. So from a year to discovery from the virus to having a vaccine, have corners been cut in terms of safety? And I can categorically say, no, that's not been the case. Safety is still the primary factor that MHRA and other EMA and FDA are looking at before they approve a vaccine for use. The difference this time is that there has been so much money thrown at these vaccines. So it was much easier to set up these trials. And we're in the middle of a pandemic. So often when you do vaccine trials, you actually have to wait a really long time to have a sufficient number of people catching the disease that you're studying. But now with the pandemic, certainly when you do, like Pfizer has done, do your study in the United States where the virus is running rampant, you basically can get to a high number of cases in a relatively short period of time. And during that time, you can observe safety and you can confirm that there's no side effects linked to the vaccine. And so no corners have been cut in terms of safety of this vaccine.
Yeah, no, that's a very important message. I think the next one you can give a quick answer to, I'm sure, from Claire. How will the dose question be resolved for the Oxford vaccine, i.e. low first, then higher?
I think only through further trials.
Yeah, and also the regulator will be looking at that data. They'll have access to the raw data and things. I mean, it's interesting. And also you could say, oh, that was a mistake, okay? But actually, I think it's great that they're honest about it, okay? It's honesty is always the best, and the same ditto with transparency, and that's been the whole problem. You know, if you think at the beginning of this year, we didn't even know who the members of SAGE were. You know, now we get the minutes, and now we know that on September 21st, they advised there should be a fire break, and the government ignored them. But Chris Whitty, I think, has been very shrewd in the way he says things. He's always said that, you know, ultimately it's ministers decide, advisors advise. Sorry, I've gone off topic a bit, but you never mind.
No, that's okay. Yes, I'm conscious we've still got a few more. So next one from David. Is there any analysis of the healthiness of a country's population and the correlation with COVID-19?
Very good question.
I think that there is a correlation between the age demographics of a nation. So generally speaking, the older a nation is, the more at risk of a high number of COVID-19 deaths. So that's thought to be one of the reasons why in Africa the number of cases of COVID-19 is relatively low, because it is relatively speaking, it's a younger continent. So people are younger in Africa, so you have less serious cases of COVID-19. But there must be other reasons for that as well. And for example, the climate in Africa is clearly different from the climate of the Midlands. And we know that the virus doesn't really like heat. So there's all these things that are very difficult to disentangle. But it does seem to be the case that there is a correlation with high number of cases and deaths, and particularly with deaths, and having a generally speaking elderly population.
Thank you.
And the thing I would add to that, I mean, I really think there is a challenge for us as a society is where we go next, because all those health disparities I mentioned that this pandemic has exposed, we actually need to decide, is when we go back to normal, is that what we're going to go back to? Is that really where we're going to? So, you know, I think all the things that the Marmara report illustrates is actually we need to ask ourselves, and if you think of how we dealt with homelessness, for example, that was unacceptable to leave people on the streets at risk of coronavirus, so we housed them. Well, actually, you know, that's something that we need to think of as a society, and actually how we deal with that. Is that acceptable? That actually homelessness, for example, costs a huge amount of money, and is that something we should deal with?
Thank you. So now at this point, because we're 2 minutes to, now I'd asked the gents in advance if they minded going slightly over if we had questions, which we do. So I think we'll probably take another 10 minutes. But in case anybody has to go off at 9 o'clock on the dot, I'm just putting in the chat now the next session. So we had another session booked. It's the 14th of January. Again, by then we're going to have a whole another month of vaccine data. So it's going to be really interesting to look at things. And of course, we'll be focusing very much on 2021 and what's going to happen. So please do join us for that. Now going back to a question again from Athanasios. Great question.
Sorry, Jennifer, just before you ask the question, are you going to send an email out reminding us all this information close to the time?
Yeah, no, great question. Not only will I, it will be on the newsletters, it will be on Facebook, and if you sign up tonight as well, I'll also send you a reminder on the day. Okay, good question.
How do you sign up?
Yeah. So if you sign up on that link, it's the same as it worked today, and hopefully all of you got a reminder email today. It'll be exactly the same.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll find you. Yes, I know exactly where you are as well, Richard. I'll definitely make sure you've got the info. Thank you. So yes, Athanasios, I think you're going to like this one, David. I was wondering if there's any data about the drop in diagnosed health issues, benign or malignant cancer, PAP testing, etc., other illnesses, due to people being afraid of going to hospital and getting potentially infected with SARS-CoV-2, or because the NHS has postponed or delayed such important diagnosis.
It's a really big issue, and as you realise, I'm obsessed about Michael Marmot, okay? But I saw a talk he gave a couple of weeks ago, and if you actually look, by whatever measure you look at, we have performed really badly, okay? So if you look at excess deaths per 100,000 people, England, we've, you know, 100 excess deaths per 100,000 people, and that's the worst in Europe, you know, ahead of Spain, Scotland, Italy, Netherlands, the US, Sweden. How that measures, I think, is tricky, because in fact we know that more people are dying at home. Now that may be because they're so scared to come into hospital. On the other hand, if you actually do surveys of where do people want to die if they've got a terminal illness, they'd rather die at home. So it's quite a difficult one to answer basically at the moment. But the impact on this on healthcare is absolutely massive. I mean, I would say the way we're dealing with this in wave two has been very different to wave one. So, you know, essentially we became a COVID service in wave one, stopped doing anything else. No one is doing that this time around because we're very worried about, you know, people who have suspected cancer need to come, etc. But it does, it creates massive problems. Every aspect of healthcare has become much more difficult because you're having to think about the infection control issues. A chap I saw last month, I'm using the motor neuron disease example as an analogy, you know, struggled to get to the GP, then presents in respiratory failure, ends up in ITU but not ventilated, then ends up on the NIV ward, which is, of course, is where all the COVID patients are, but he hasn't got COVID, okay? So then you've got the ethical issue of how you manage someone who hasn't got COVID, where they're at very high risk of getting it. And then having to plan, end-of-life care dressed like Dustin Hoffman is a nightmare. And then you've got the relative saying, oh, can we go and see them? And having to say, well, if you go and see them, you won't be able to go to the funeral because you're going to have to self-isolate. So every aspect of care is very difficult. But I cannot emphasize enough, if you've got a medical problem, please speak to a healthcare professional. It's just the mode of communication may be different. And I would say it almost surprises me we haven't had more complaints, but those complaints there have been, it's all about lack of communication. So, we're introducing much more, you know, FaceTime type calls with next of kin and things like that. Yes, it is a problem. And I think this is a reflection that we have failed to invest in health and social care in the way that other countries have done. That's not me saying this. Chief executive of Roche told this to Newsnight that basically the UK has made a choice not to invest in health and social care, and we got hit by a pandemic.
Yeah, thank you. And of course, that was an issue before all of this, wasn't it?
Every winter, you had someone like me saying, it's outrageous, you know, NHS crisis, people queued in trolleys in A&Es. Okay, you cannot have people queued in trolleys in A&Es in a pandemic. So that creates massive problems in terms of how you plan bed flow safely.
People, the general public, are just used to hearing that every year and have probably got desensitized because I think for 20 years they've heard how the NHS is on the brink every year. Just because we've heard it so many times doesn't mean it's not desperately true.
But also that's problems staff-wise as well. Mm. And the biggest risk at the moment, I think, is complacency. And people think, oh, vaccine on the way. And I'm sorry, this is really boring, but, you know, have a quiet Christmas, wash your hands, wear a mask. It's very boring, but, you know, it's better that way. We are really close to the edge. And I keep going back to, you know, we've got half the number of ITU beds of other countries. And if you look, you know, the US now, more people dying every day than died in 9/11. I mean, it's just incredible.
I didn't know that. Oh, goodness gracious me.
3,000 died yesterday.
Crikey. That's a really astonishing way of putting it. Okay. And actually, segueing beautifully into Martin's question here, because Martin asks, is there a potentially increased risk of transmission due to those immunised not taking care regards hygiene, for example? But if I can tack on to that, certainly in pandemic one, if you like, lockdown one, people were terrified of touching surfaces. The fear isn't quite there now. Is the risk not quite there with the surfaces as we thought it might have been? So Martin's Absolutely. Question as it's well.
Really good question. I'll be interested in Wilhelm's answer on this because and it's what we call fomites, okay?
Yeah.
Servers and things like that. And it's a tricky one. And then it also leads into aerosols and how much, because the WHO didn't really push the aerosol side of things until much later on, basically.
I think I have to be very careful here because I don't want to say anything that could be misconstrued. But I think at the start of the pandemic, we overestimated the role of surfaces and we underestimated the role of airborne transmission. And now I think we believe that, and there's data to say that airborne transmission is probably the most important of the two. So that is basically one of us being in a room filled with other people where one person might have COVID and that person will spread it to the other people in that room. That doesn't mean that there is no role for the transmission via surfaces. It is probably not as important as airborne transmission, but you could even argue that if you want to minimize transmission over surfaces, that intervention is really easy because you just wash your hands, right? And right now, if you go to the supermarket, there will be there will be these hand sanitizers everywhere that you can use. I would still continue to use them, advise to continue to use them, because it's so easy to use and it's, you might further reduce your risk.
The airflow thing is a real challenge. And, you know, I think there's going to be challenges in terms of actually how we design our hospital wards, for example. And it's not just about single rooms. It's down to, you know, things like the height of the ceiling. So, you know, one of the hospitals I work has got old Nightingale wards. And actually they may be fine, actually, because there's lots of space. Whereas some of the newer hospitals, if you've got a cramped bay, that may create a problem. But it's difficult because, we're in the middle of this. And, you know, all sorts of things I can think about testing and swab. My hunch, again, not evidence, so anecdotal alert, I think neurological patients, I think, are particularly tricky because if you've had a brain injury, it's pretty hard to complain of loss of sense of smell. And there may be many reasons for fever and things. So therefore, if you get it, it's easier to spread it. So I'm completely obsessed about tracheostomies because obviously you can catch it and then potentially spread it. But that's a little bit niche. But I actually feel this year I've turned into a public health doctor, not a neurologist, which is very strange.
I think many of people in infectious diseases or microbiology have suddenly developed a strong interest in public health. Yeah.
We've got one more question, which hopefully we can do in a couple of minutes, so I may meet that at 10 minutes over there, I promise. And it's actually from my hubby, who's listening in downstairs. He's put a long one, so you're in trouble, hubby, when I come off here. Right. He says, what future standard operating procedures can be instigated by the World Health Organization and corresponding national organizations to prepare for future pandemics to prevent an entire year's loss of life and productivity akin to 2020 from occurring? And do you believe that overpopulation and human ecological impact will result in similar future pandemics? And if so, to what extent?
Right. That's a great question. I'm afraid I'm not going to do justice by trying to give a very short answer to it. There's definitely a role for overpopulation and climate change because, I'm going to take one step back. The reason why we have pandemics is essentially because a virus jumps. It's often a virus these days because bacteria we can still treat with antibiotics for a few decades at most, but we'll worry about that later. But viruses jump from animals to humans, and that's the start of a pandemic. That's how it looks like this pandemic has started. So it jumped from bats to humans in China, and that set off the pandemic. And that's how HIV started, that's how flu pandemics start, that's how Ebola starts. And because of overpopulation and climate change, you get more interactions between humans and animals. You get more people move into places where they would normally not be living in. Animals have to migrate because the climate is changing. And that creates all kind, basically a perfect storm for viruses to make that host jump, as we call it, from animals to humans. So this is certainly not the last pandemic. This is a pretty bad one, probably the worst one we've seen in a century, but there will be other ones. And the WHO has, generally speaking, been quite good during this pandemic. It's just that governments have not been listening, or not all governments have been listening. And I think that the lesson that we should take from this is that we have to be prepared for pandemics. So that means, for example, stockpiling PPE so that we don't have the same disaster as we had about access to PPE in spring this year. And that we have to have a really good global surveillance system, which actually worked really well this time around with COVID, but we have to continue to do that to pick up unusual new cases of disease. Because pandemics, to some extent, are predictable. We know that there's going to be next pandemic. What we don't know is what form it will take.
I think that's an extremely important point, because part of the problem about the news stories, we keep focusing on, you know, getting through wave one, getting through wave two. Actually, I think it's inevitable that, you know, things are going to go up after Christmas. That's just a statement of fact. But also, how we plan for pandemics. You know, in fact, I think Operation Cygnus showed that our pandemic flu panic should have been top of our risk register, and that didn't happen, even to the extent that even the Daily Telegraph reported that Jeremy Hunt walked out of the planning exercise when it, you know, so it's you know, people won't like this, but it's inevitable if we're having global travel that there's going to be other pandemics. And if you go back to 1918, I think it was the troop ship Lithuania from the US. So it wasn't Spanish flu, it actually came from a farm in Iowa. A bunch of soldiers stuck on a ship that, you know, that spread it. Obviously, if you get in a metal box called an aeroplane, similar things going to happen. So it's going to be a challenge on one, how we detect it, but also how we react to it is going to be a challenge. And we haven't, you know, I haven't heard any debate about how we're going to, how international air travel is going to evolve from this. You know, and there's some really big questions there about how we, it alludes to back what I was saying about vaccination versus non-vaccination in different countries.
And much as it would be lovely to carry on, we're definitely out of time. I'm so grateful to both of you for giving your time in answering those questions. I think that's been a really interesting evening, so thank you so much. And those of you that have joined in, you've asked some fantastic questions, so thank you very much for your participation too. It'd be great to hear your views and your feedback in the chat, so please do let us know if it's been useful, informative. By all means, add other things in there that we haven't covered, and we can cover those again in the January session. I do hope you'll join us then, virtually, albeit virtually, perhaps you can give our panel a round of applause as well. So, thank you very much. I can see lots of people clapping their hands there. Thank you. I even saw Santa among you as well somewhere. That was rather interesting. So, yes, somebody had a Santa backdrop. So even Santa was popping in for some info. So yes, thank you, chaps, and good night, good evening, however you wish me to put that, to everybody that was on the call. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Should we just stay on for a minute?
Yeah.
Nice to see you as well, Jennifer. Thanks for hosting that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I feel like I was definitely the, I don't even know how to put it, but it wasn't me, basically.
Some good questions there, weren't they?
Very good.
Yeah, yeah, I like it.
Very, very good. Yeah really good.
I can see Tris Harris from the Bronze Group Standard was there, so he said thanks very much.
Yeah, no, it's good. Great.
It's good to know that in January, when we've got the next meeting, Jennifer, that we'll still be talking about Brexit and they might be thinking about a deal.
Oh, yeah. We've been talking about it for the past 4 years, so I don't see that going away. Jim, my cat was snoring throughout that, which was rather embarrassing. Bless her soul. Right. Just entering these, ending these now. Nick, whilst you're on, are you going to be joining us at the exec on the weekend?
I'm glad you reminded me, but yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes, I will be having a look at that.
Lovely, okay. All right then, in that case, I shall leave you to it as we're just going to quickly wash up here. So if there's any issues with getting in on Saturday, do let me know. But thank you very, very much for joining us.
No worries, and thanks, David, and thanks, Wilhelm. It's
good fun. To see you. Looking forward to that trip to the pub.
Yeah, aren't we all?
So I'm just trying to think, it would be good to have that recording.
I need to end that, actually.
Yeah, you need to edit this. Yeah, you can stop the